I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:18 on Thursday, March 27th, 2025, and we're here in room 120. Please silence cell phones at this time. Members present are Representative Moore, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Representative Carrick. Our record secretary is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juno LIO is Emma Turner. Thank you all for helping us today. Today we have introductory hearings on three bills. We'll start with House Bill 58, the OPA public advocate appointment from Representative Fields. After that, we have House Bill 35 on prisoner tablets from Representative Himshute, followed by an introductory hearing of House Bill 16 on campaign contribution limits from Representative Shrocky's office. So first up today, we have Representative Fields and staff, if you'd like to come up and present House Bill 58 on the OPA public advocate appointment. And we do have invited testimony on this bill, which we'll take after the intro hearing.
Thank you, Zach Fields, House District 17.
Courtney Owen, staff rep Fields.
I introduced House Bill 58 when a constituent who had worked in the Office of the Public Advocate explained to me that the selection of the head of the Office of the Public Advocate, or OPA, is very different from the selection of the public defender, even though OPA and the PD have largely similar functions and work on many of the same types of cases. If anything, work of the Office of the Public Advocate is more complex. So I put forward a bill to make the selection of the director of the Office of the Public Advocate analogous to the public defender. And I would argue that this should have been done 40 years ago. And in no way does this bill reflect a criticism of the current director of OPA. This is simply a structural fix. So a little background on the Office of Public Advocacy. It was established in 1984 by a bill put forward by the then governor to provide legal advocacy and guardianship to vulnerable Alaskans. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that this dual structure of the public defender and OPA does save the state money relative to having to hire outside counsel in cases where, say, the PD is conflicted and couldn't represent all indigent clients who need representation. It's also important to remember that OPA provides really critical services for children and vulnerable adults. So if you haven't worked with OPA before, OPA represents clients in a variety of civil and criminal matters, including advocacy for abused and neglected children, and protective proceedings, public guardianship for incapacitated adults, guardian ad litem for child in need of aid in civil custody cases, advocacy for victims of elder fraud, legal representation for parents involved in China and civil custody cases, and criminal defense for people accused of crime where the PD has a conflict of interest. So remember, OPA was established in 1984. The Public Defender Agency was established prior to that in 1969. And the Public Defender Agency provides constitutionally mandated legal representation of vulnerable clients, including legal representation in criminal cases. So again, looking at the work of OPA versus the PD, the scope of OPA's work is broader. Both agencies are essential to provide constitutionally required legal representation. So what's the same? What's different about OPA and the public defender? They're both government agencies that provide legal services. They both operate under the purview of the Department of Administration. They both serve vulnerable Alaskans. In some cases, OPA and the PD will represent clients in the same case. It is important to recognize that OPA does provide those services to vulnerable Alaskans, be they youth or the elderly in particular. So, notwithstanding substantial overlap in the work of lawyers employed within the PD and OPA, the selection of the director of OPA versus the director of the public defender agency or the public defender is extremely different. So, selection of the director of the public defender agency, appointed by the governor from among two or more candidates nominated by the Judicial Council, subject to confirmation by a majority of members of the legislature. They serve a term of 4 years and may be reappointed, and the PD is subject to removal by the governor with good cause. Contrast that to the director of OPA, which is appointed by the governor, not subject to confirmation, no term limits, and serves at the pleasure of the governor and can be removed at any time. So pretty different in terms of selection, even though both agencies are essential and provide largely overlapping legal services. And in fact, OPA, if anything, has a broader purview. So that's a summary of both the bill and of the work that the respective agencies do.
And I will just note Representative McCabe joined us about 5 minutes ago. At this time, let's go to our invited testifier, which is Brant McGee from Independent Law, who's an independent law practice professional. Mr. McGee, if you could please put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Brant McGee. I was the first public advocate appointed in 1984, and I served until 2003. This bill is a good government bill that is designed to correct the mistake made in 1984 when the agency was created, and the means of the appointment of the public advocate was designated in statute. It should have been the same selection process as the public defender, but it wasn't for reasons that I can't tell you because I just don't know. I was appointed through a series of accidents by a process of elimination that I never did figure out. The three reasons are as follows. One, it addresses an obvious conflict of interest. The governor is the head of the Department of Law and other agencies of state government that can initiate actions involving Alaskan citizens that are represented by the Office of Public Advocacy. And as a result of that obvious conflict, there are risks associated with the conduct of the administrator of the Office of Public Advocacy. The second good government reason is that the public advocate can serve has a person responsible for accountability. And by that, let me give you one illustration. We discovered in the course of our work as guardians ad litem for abused and neglected children taken into state custody, that one of our clients, who was 6 years old, had been the subject of 16 different reports of harm that were investigated by what was then called the Division of Family and Youth Services. No effective action was taken to protect this child, even after all of those investigations. The girl was raped. We made a big stink about that. We went to the media, we went to the press, and as a result of that, the following year, we got the best child protection statute in the country, and we got more money in the child protection system to support social workers. And the reason that that level of accountability is important is because some of the proceedings in which the Office of Public Advocacy is involved, for example, all children's proceedings are confidential. Nobody will ever know what goes on in those proceedings unless there's somebody who can take egregious violations to the press and to the media to try to create effective public action. I should tell you that those types of proceedings are confidential for very good reason, but we got court orders that would allow us to explain the circumstances of the case without any identifying information. Other confidential proceedings involve elderly adults or adults who suffer from mental illness or addiction. Those are also confidential, but those are also cases in which we could obtain court orders to identify weaknesses or violations in the system. Finally, the third reason is that this position is not a policy making or policy implementing agency. The responsibilities of the Office of Public Advocacy are set out in the Constitution of the U.S. and also Alaska's Constitution by the statute, which provides detailed descriptions of the types of cases in which we were obliged to provide representation, and also court rule. We also guide the lawyers by the Code of Professional Responsibility to provide zealous advocacy for all of our clients, no matter what their station. those are the three reasons that I think that you should look very carefully at this bill, and I'd certainly invite any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGee, for your testimony. Did we have other invited testifiers on this bill? Let's see. Susan D. Pietro? Is she online? Oh, she is online. Welcome, Ms. D. Pietro, the Executive Director of Alaska Judicial Council. If you could also please put your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. My name is Suzanne D. Pietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And I was invited to talk to the committee a little bit about the Judicial Council and to explain some of the council's procedures. So first of all, I will just very briefly, for those of you who may not be familiar, I will just go over the Judicial Council is established in Article 4 of the Constitution. The members include lawyers and non-lawyers who are appointed without regard to political affiliation. So it's a nonpartisan body. And the Judicial Council has several constitutional and statutory duties. The duties that I think are of most interest to the committee today would be the council's statutory duty to screen and nominate applicants for the role of public defender. As the sponsor mentioned, I believe it is the intent of this bill for the Judicial Council to use the same procedures or substantially the same procedures that it uses in its screening and nomination of applicants for public defender as that it would use those same procedures for the public advocate. So understanding that, I thought that I would just go very quickly through the council's procedures that it uses when there is a vacancy in the role of public defender, and with the understanding that the council likely would use these same procedures for the public advocate if the bill became law. So first of all, the process begins when with an announcement of a vacancy, when there's a vacancy in the position. There's a solicitation of applicants. This is widely publicized. A letter is sent to every lawyer in the state, and press releases are put out and information is posted on the council's website. It's a five-week application process. It's a 27-page application in which the people who want to apply for the job are asked to tell the council every legal employer that they have had, their education, their legal experience, their trial practice experience, and to provide a number of references of people who have direct experience with their work, and also to provide waivers so the council can access their confidential personnel files and their confidential bar discipline records. At the close of the application process, the council publicizes the names of people who have applied, and it sends out a survey, an electronic survey, to every member of the bar who may have direct professional experience with the applicants, and asks each member of the bar to rate those individuals' qualifications for the position. So the applicants are rated on a number of qualities that the council has found to be critical to these types of positions, including legal ability, temperament, impartiality, fairness, integrity, and overall performance. And the results of that bar survey, when they are completed, are public and posted on the council's website for everyone to see. Meanwhile, the staff is conducting an investigation of all the information that the applicants provided. So staff contacts each and every legal employer that the person has worked for and requests feedback about their performance. The council also contacts references and other people who have been recently involved in litigation with the applicant, whether as co-counsel, opposing counsel, or as a judge in the case, and sends them a questionnaire for detailed feedback about their performance. The council conducts criminal records checks, credit history check, the council looks through those personnel files and bar discipline files and does other investigation as needed. Importantly, the council takes comments from the public throughout this process, so anyone, any member of the public who would like to tell the council something about the applicants is welcome to do so. The council also holds a public hearing on the applicants, and a 45-minute interview with each person who has applied, and then the council nominates of all the people who have applied the most qualified in the group, and the council determines the individuals who are most qualified using criteria set out in our bylaws. Those criteria are professional competence, which includes writing ability and speaking ability, diligence and administrative skills, which of course are critically important to the role of public defender and would be also for the role of public advocate, integrity, fairness, temperament, very important characteristic for good managers, judgment and common sense, legal and life experience, commitment, a demonstrated commitment to the public and community service, and a demonstrated commitment to equal justice and the legal needs of all communities in Alaska. So those are the criteria, and the council votes in public session and nominates at least two individuals. Usually the council does nominate more, but again, it's the most qualified. Only the most qualified of the group go forward, and then those names are sent to the governor. So that was a pretty quick summary. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. DiPietro. And do we have any questions from committee members for our invited testifiers or the bill's sponsor, Representative Holland?
All right, thank you, through the chair. Just a quick question. I think I recall a lot of this from community regional affairs already, so I appreciate that we're seeing this, and it was a bill that I recall made a lot of sense then. So the only question I've got at this point is there anything new that has changed or emerged in the last couple of weeks since this came out of CRA that would change anything that we've talked about? Because I feel pretty comfortable with this, but there's been a week or two, and if there's anything that's jiggled loose, it would be useful to know. Otherwise, I'm pretty comfortable with this.
Through the chair, nope, no changes.
Thank you, and I neglected to do this at the beginning, and I do apologize to our community and regional affairs folks that have already heard this legislation, but I was going to ask the sponsor's office to walk through the sectional of the bill.
Okay, for the record, Courtney Owen, staff director at Fields. I will go over the sectional. Section 1 amends AS 1326750A, which changes the title from Commissioner of Administration to Public Advocate. Section 2 amends AS 3630305A and changes the title from Director of the Office of Public Advocacy to Public Advocate. Section 3 amends AS 3630850B31 and changes the title of Director of the Office of Public Advocacy to Public Advocate. Section 4 amends AS 4421400 to read with reference to the Public Advocacy Office. The office is administered by the Public Advocate. Section 5 amends AS 4421 by adding a new section that reads Section 4421405, Appointment, Removal, and Vacancy. And it adds subsection A, which directs the governor to appoint the public advocate for a term of 4 years from persons nominated by the Judicial Council and subject to majority confirmation by the joint legislature. Retention of the public advocate requiring only similar legislative approval adds subsection B, which lays out the removal process for the public advocate, a power held by the governor, who need only submit a report stating the reasons and notify the legislature of the report within 10 days after the convening of the regular session. Subsection C requires eligibility. Required eligibility entails acquiring admittance to practice law in the state of Alaska. Subsection D, during vacancy, the governor has discretionary authority to appoint an acting public advocate and the joint duty with judicial counsel to fill the vacancy as soon as possible. And the next five sections are conforming changes. And then section 11, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska, is amended by adding a new section titled Transition, which reads subsection A provides for the continuity of all orders, regulations, contracts, rights, liabilities, and obligations issued, created, or adopted by the predecessor to the envisioned public advocate, and by the pre-existing law changed by this bill. Subsection B provides for the continuity of governance by allowing the individual employed as the director of the Office of Public Advocacy on the day before the effective date of this act to serve as the public advocate until the governor appoints a new public advocate.
Thank you, Ms. Owens. Any final questions from committee members? Seeing none, we will be setting House Bill 58 aside and hearing this again at our next hearing. Thank you to the sponsor's office and to our testifiers. At this time, we are going to transition to House Bill 35 on prisoner tablets, and we will take a brief at ease to switch to that hearing from Rep. Himshut. House State Affairs back on the record, and we have Representative Himshut and staff with us. If you all could put yourself on the record and walk through the presentation of House Bill 35.
Hi, thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm Rebecca Himshut, representative for House District 2, which is Yakutat to Heidelberg, 500 incredible coastal miles here in Southeast Alaska. And with me is...
My name is Ella Lubin. I'm staff to Representative Himshut.
Thank you for hearing House Bill 35 today. We're excited to bring this bill to you. Some of you will recognize it. It's been around before. This is the third legislature with it in this form, and previously, four legislatures ago, it was coupled with another bill to provide identification for folks upon release. It was decoupled, and that legislation passed 2 years ago, and so this is what's left of that bill from 8 years ago. So this bill has been around before, like I said. We are trying to bring Alaska into alignment with the other 48 states who allow tablets in their departments of correction facility, Department of Corrections facilities. Our goals with this bill are basically to reduce recidivism, which Alaska has arguably very high recidivism. So through additional access to training, through additional access to family visits, and just access to learning how to use devices that are commonly in use in the general public. Folks, when they do leave, and 95% of our folks will leave custody, when they do, they'll be in a better situation to not come back under those same circumstances. We also will reduce some security threats by having fewer transports to medical care, and possibly even increase medical care through telehealth using the devices. There is a pilot program underway with very limited, again, because it's not spelled out in statute, the pilot program has very limited functionality on the devices, but it is the department is reporting back with very positive outcomes for that. So basically right now, because we don't address it in statute, DOC really can't provide tablets broadly in their facilities. There is a pilot program going on in order to figure out how it would work, because we aren't going to just open the internet. So these devices are not a luxury. There are no games on them, but they will have the law library. They will have access to the various training courses that are available in DOC right now. And again, they'll have telehealth and visitation opportunities. So we want to make sure that we have the policies in place that allow enough latitude for supervisors within the department to provide these, but within guardrails. So with that, I'm not sure what I'm missing, but I'm sure Ella can fill in any blanks, and we're happy to take questions or provide the sectional.
Let's actually walk through the sectional, if that's all right, Ms. Lubin.
For the record, Ella Lubin, staff to Representative Himshute. In Section 1, it includes four important changes made to current Alaska Statute 3330.015, subsection A. The first is an amended list of devices that prisoners are prohibited from having in their cell to include telephones. It also includes new language prohibiting computers and electronic tablets unless used for a purpose approved in a later newly added subsection. The second change adds the television rating of TVMA under the list of prohibited movie and television show ratings. The third change adds an accepted use for electronic devices. Accepted uses for electronic devices. These accepted uses include rehabilitative and reentry plan purposes, access to legal materials, access to healthcare services, and expanded visitation opportunities. The fourth change in Section 1 adds language prohibiting correctional facilities from charging fees for email or online visitation services. In Section 2, it adds a new subsection F to Alaska Statute 33.30.015, stating that online visitation may supplement, not supplant, in-person visitation to the extent practicable. In Section 3, it adds clarifying language to state statute regarding the applicability of an effective date.
Great, thank you. Do we have questions from committee members? We also do have three invited testifiers, so we could hold questions. Okay, I'm seeing that that's going to be a good idea. We will go first to, we can go first to Terry Tibbett, if she's ready. I see she's ready. Welcome, Ms. Tibbett, with Alaska Reentry Partnership. If you'd like to put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Carrick, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Terry Tibbett, for the record, and I am the coordinator for the Alaska Reentry Partnership, which is a coalition of reentry coalitions across the state. There's one in Fairbanks, there's one in Matsu, Anchorage. We also have one in Kenai and Juneau, Nome, Kodiak, and Ketchikan. So eight coalitions across the state are working on helping people transition out of incarceration into the community, making sure that they have access to housing, treatment, health care, and things that people need to get back on their feet. Today presenting will be myself, and I'm also the co-chair of the Juneau Reentry Coalition here in Juneau, but also Barbara Monger from Matsu Reentry Coalition is on the line. She'll be next, and then Bobby Dorton from Healing Homes from Fairbanks. He's a peer advocate, so he'll be on. So we have a lot of partners. You can see in the left-hand column on the screen, or hopefully you have this in front of you, but if not, then you could...
Ms. Tibbett, I just want to note for the committee members, we don't have this presentation in front of us, but we will put it on BASIS as soon as this meeting is over.
Okay.
And we apologize that we don't have it in paper copy.
No worries. If you can see the screen, because I'm not going to read everything that's on these, on this paper or on the screen, but I'll quickly run through the points that are on each page of the PowerPoint. So eight coalitions. We also have state partners. We work very closely with the Alaska Mental Health Trust, with the Department of Corrections, with the Division of Behavioral Health and the Department of Health, and also the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. They attend our meetings. We all work together to coordinate efforts so that, again, to create a smooth transition for people returning to the community after incarceration. We also have community partners across the state, NeighborWorks in Anchorage. Again, this is a long list, but you can see that there are partners across the state who provide staff, they provide support, they provide resources, and we all work together to provide support for people returning to the community. HB 35, Access to Digital Technology in Prisons, is, as you know, you've heard, it removes a barrier in state law that restricts inmates inside correctional facilities from utilizing certain electronic devices, such as computers, digital tablets. And we support the bill because if people have better access to digital technology in today's world, they're more likely to have access to programs and activities that are rehabilitative in nature. Better education opportunities, training opportunities, treatment, visitation, and a whole host of activities and programs that have been shown to increase the likelihood of success after returning to the community and reduce the likelihood of recidivism or repeated criminal behavior. The Alaska Reentry Partnership supports the efforts. As mentioned, there's a lot of benefits that will, you can see the list here that I've pretty much already mentioned, but there's a longer list of things that these tablets and other digital technology can be used for. In today's world, people need to be digitally literate in order to succeed, to be able to fill out applications, to apply for a job, for banking, communication, and more. And people who've been incarcerated for decades could really benefit from having access to digital technology while incarcerated, so they can get themselves kind of up to speed on what life will be like when they get out. And then we just want to go on record as saying we support DOC's efforts to improve the digital infrastructure, not only with the tablets, but also whatever else is needed within the department in terms of infrastructure to promote access to telehealth, video conferencing, closed circuit education channels, digital tablets, computer labs, and more. I'm going to be very quick with this, but the recidivism rate has gone down since 2015, when it was at its high, not at its highest, but in these past few years, it was at 63.17 in 2015, and for the most recent number that we have based on the way they measure, in FY21, it's gone down to 54.59%. So we see that it's just coincidental, maybe coincidence or not. We don't have the data to show. We're working on it, but we don't have the data to show the correlation between this reduced recidivism, numbers, and the reentry efforts that have happened since 2015. This on the screen in front of you, and you will have it on paper at some point, there's a whole host of things that have begun in Alaska since 2015, including the Mental Health Trust putting a lot of resources towards the reentry coalitions, the reentry case managers. The Department of Health created a reentry program. The treatment in prisons has increased. reentry unit in DOC has begun. That wasn't happening before 2015. There's some legislation that's passed. Therapeutic courts have expanded. There's been a real concerted effort by the state of Alaska to create programs and activities that are reentry in nature. And those, we can say that the recidivism rate has gone down and these things have gone up. So, again, we can't prove, but we can say possibly they correlate. And we do know I wrote down some Alaska data for you to review at another time, but I'm just going to skip ahead to the national research. And there is national research to show the correlation between increased reentry efforts and reduced recidivism. So I encourage folks to look at the reports that are on the screen from the National Reentry Resource Center, from the Council of State Governments Justice Center, and just look at these, and you can see where there is correlation, where they have done the research, and we can show that. With that, I would like to thank you. I put this on the last screen. The Alaska Community Reentry Program is what we work under. This was a program that began from the Mental Health Trust in partnership with DOC, the Department of Health, and the Reentry Coalitions. We all worked together to put this program together in 2017, and we've been operating pretty robustly and expanding our efforts since 2017. And there's a link to that here. With that, I want to invite Barbara Monger, who is the Reentry Coalition Coordinator for the MATSU Reentry Coalition, if I can.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Monger, we'll turn to you.
All right. My name is Barbara Monger, and I am the coordinator for the MATSU Reentry Coalition. I'm here representing our Reentry Coalition in support of HB 35. I have been the coordinator for the MATSU Reentry Coalition for the last 5.5 years. Our coalition consists of state agencies such as the Alaska Department of Labor and the Alaska Department of Corrections, community substance treatment centers such as Set Free Alaska and True North Recovery, MATSU Health Services, tribal agencies, nonprofit, and private community service agencies. The close community partnership we have through the Reentry Coalition has made it easier to provide wraparound services. Our reentry case managers start the planning with individuals releasing from incarceration at least 30 days prior to their release. The wraparound services our reentry case managers provide include comprehensive goal and case planning, housing supports, employment supports, parole and probation supports, and referrals for substance and mental health treatment. Our reentry case managers also assist returning individuals with obtaining daily wear clothing and hygiene items, assisting them with filling out applications for Medicaid and food stamps, and assist them with other services as needed for the individuals to be successful. The MATSU Reentry Coalition supports House Bill 35 because this bill would help to remove barriers that restrict inmates inside correctional institutions from utilizing certain electronic devices, such as computers or digital tablets, for improved access to rehabilitative programming and activities. We also support DOC's efforts to expand digital technology for vocational training, education treatment and recovery, reentry planning, housing and employment assistance, telehealth, peer support, faith-based, tribal, visitation, and more while individuals are still incarcerated. Early access to services would increase the likelihood for individuals to successfully reintegrate into the community once they are released from incarceration, and successfully reentry means the safer communities. Thank you for taking your time for listening to me.
Thank you, Ms. Monger. And we can now turn to Bobby Dorton in Fairbanks.
Hello, everyone. My name is Bobby Dorton. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about my story. I went to prison. I think I've been justice involved 14 years, 4 months of my life. I went to my last time in prison. I went to prison for 8 years and 8 months. I had to do 5 years and 8 months inside and 3 years on ankle monitor. And while I was in prison, I wanted to learn how to read because I really didn't know how to read. So I did a lot of reading while I was there. I got into the little bit of programming that they had there, like substance abuse programming. And I really hungered for, like, having a career once I got out, but really I didn't have the capability of studying these, different avenues of careers. They did have a culinary arts, but it's very limited. Not very many people get picked for that, and you have to be in the right institution to get picked for that. Besides that, I think they have a few programs now, like welding programs and driving programs, but kudos on DOC for bringing that. That was not there when I was there. But I wanted to stress the idea of what I could have been if I had, with that hunger and that time on my hands, just sitting there kind of being warehouse, you know, stored away in prison. They were spending a lot of money for me to be there. Every day I think they were spending up to $150 a day or maybe a little less for me to be in prison. I was ready to learn at that time, and everything was on hold. I had to wait till I got out, and then I went to trainings, school, and I was able to acquire the career that I wanted. But while I was in prison, I could have been getting ready, and I was basically just warehoused. And so I talk about that because here's the thing, is that it's not always the same as my story. Everyone's story is different. But here's what I see, because I worked in the reentry world now for, I would say, 7 years, right? I've worked in the reentry world at Fairbanks Native Association and at Fairbanks Canada Chiefs Conference, helped design and build a program to help reentrants. And this is what's happening with the tribal community of reentry. Once they get out, we basically lost them. They don't have the time to do the things that they could have utilized while they're in, and they end up doing labor jobs, different jobs, not really their heart jobs, not their jobs that they're compassionate about, like peer support or counseling or anything like that, because that lived experience is really, really important to work with the clinicians in the field. When they work together, the clinicians can kind of keep them accountable, keep an eye on them, and they're able to just guide them in a way to help the people that are going through mental health issues or substance abuse issues. It's really important to have that team in place. And so I say this because I think if there was a training tablet in prison, the sky's the limit. Like, I could have been really at least a master's level clinician by now, maybe. And I'm saying this because I sat there on idle a very long time. I counted calendars. I waited and waited and waited, and I kept reading, and I kept having faith that one day I'll get out and I'll be able to help people. That did happen, but I think my education level would have been a lot higher if I was given the opportunity. And so I share this with you all because we have a chance right now to actually make our community safer and better if we allow this. And I wholeheartedly believe that people will get out and have careers, not just jobs, because the idea of society is that when they get out, they can work at McDonald's or one of these fast food places, or they can wash dishes. Of course, somebody's going to do that for a very short time, and they're going to get back into what they know. They're going to know how to survive, and that's probably the wrong way to survive. And so by putting opportunity like this and help molding the people, I think that we'd be able to have a better, better Alaska. And so I know I'm forgetting about half of what I was going to say today, but I think that I hope that painted a picture for all you guys. And I truly believe in the model of education, training, and counseling. And that's what these iPads would do, or these pads would do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dorton, and thank you to all of our invited testifiers. Do we have questions for our testifiers or for the bill's sponsor? Vice Chair Story?
Thank you, and thank you to the testifiers, and thank you for the testifier online who talked about how his experience. I really appreciate that. The question is actually possibly for the bill sponsor and the testifiers, and it has to do with something. I've heard this bill before, and I've been very much in favor of the bill, but some of the people who were concerned wanted to always know about the security level of the devices that will be used, and I would like to hear an update on that with this bill.
Through the chair, thank you. Vice Chair Story, I'd like to offer that Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson is online. We did have a show-and-tell session in our previous committee. We might be able to arrange for that again. And this would nothing in this bill includes funding. That's going to be a whole different thing if that time comes or when that time comes. But this is a completely offline system, so to speak. But I think Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson could speak to it better.
Yes, we do have Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson, if she wants to answer that question.
Thank you. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Representative Story, absolutely. The security features are a concern of the department as well. We do have a pilot operations program running at Highland Mountain Correctional Facility. We utilize the vendor that operates multiple corrections type of network systems such to be able to provide tablets to the offender population in many other correctional settings. And so what they have identified and what they have structured is a very closed network that only allows not only content that is approved by the department to be seen on the tablets, but also it will disconnect. Currently, the network is so tight and restricted that if they were to even take the tablet into their cells right now, it wouldn't even show them the handbook that is downloaded on the tablets. So we are building our own internal trust and faith in the possibilities of utilizing these tablets through this pilot program, but we are seeing a pretty limited and restricted network that allows the population to use these.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that, Ms. Wilkerson. So could you tell me a little bit about the pilot and how these tablets are being used right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Through the chair to Representative Story. So currently we have the tablet program, pilot program at Highland Mountain. All offenders are eligible to receive the tablet. Offenders are eligible following the orientation. Some of them receive a tablet the same day that they are admitted. And the orientation does consist of medical and mental health assessments. the population will watch a facility video. They do the PREA acknowledgments. And they will meet with their institutional probation officer. Offenders are issued a unique PIN number that allows them to access the tablet. Tablets have the digital law library. It has the offender handbook on it. And then it also allows for the professional visitation with their attorneys. We do not offer any family or friends visitation on the tablets currently, but we do allow electronic mail currently to be received. It is a service that is paid by the sender of the message. It costs about half the price of a stamp. They do allow for instant messaging, which is currently monitored and tracked by the staff in the facility. It's no different than staff listening to their phone calls currently. And then we have expanded, and we are piloting communication from the superintendent with the population. So we had an issue a few months ago where there was a maintenance issue and the water had to be shut off. So the superintendent was able to distribute and send out a notification that went to everyone on the tablet
about where bottled water was going to be stored, how long the water was going to be shut off, and so on and so forth. So it just really kind of helps with the communication with staff. We're also piloting requests for information, so the RFI process. Our process department-wide is for the offender to get a piece of paper, they write out and complete the form. The form goes into a box. A sergeant will come around a couple times a day, will pick up the request for information and go distribute those, whether to medical or to disciplinary or to jobs or wherever that request is going to go. And then the individual on the other end will write a response that goes back into the box, and then a sergeant will come around. So it's very a manual process. We are trying to convert that over into using technology to have it become an automated process where the offender can log on to an RFI, complete the form on the tablet, and then it's automatically distributed to the right location. And the same process we are converting over from the grievance process, which again is a very manual handwritten form process. Those manual processes are still in place. So the technology that we're trying to use is an alternative, which we want to get to, but for those that are not, don't have a tablet or don't want a tablet, they still can use the manual process for completing the form. And then more recently, the end of February, we are looking at expanding the education that is available on the program. We're exploring some career exploration and preparation, computer literacy skills, employment and work skills. So there's a few education materials that we are just now deploying onto the tablets. It's very limited. We have not deployed it throughout all the tablets, and again, it's just within the last couple of weeks. So that's kind of how we're using the Highland Mountain tablets currently. We do have another program that is running out of Goose Creek that we have partnered with the courts, and the courts have issued tablets to Highland Mountain, but also to Goose Creek, and we're doing hearings between Goose Creek and the court system where we are setting aside locations for the offenders to actually participate in their court hearings via the tablets instead of having to transport them to and from court. And we're in the process of getting that implemented at Highland Mountain as well. That's a completely separate network. It's separate from the pilot tablet program at Highland Mountain, but it is another tablet technology type of program that we are implementing as well. That's kind of where we're currently at with the pilot programs.
Follow up?
Thank you for that, Ms. Wilkerson. I was hoping to hear more about computer coding, things like that, technology skills that people can bring out when they re-enter. So I see that you're not quite there yet. I also am wondering, when I heard this bill before, there were just certain security companies that operated in correctional facilities across the United States, and I'm assuming that whatever you're using is something approved through that system. And if not, what is the security system that you're using?
Through the chair to Representative Story, we are not at the answer to your first question, we're not quite there yet with the Coding Academy or providing that level of education through the tablets. We want to get there. We want to, you know, give them the nationwide workforce and some of the issues that everybody is facing with their workforce. Utilizing the tablets could be something that helps assist with expansion of programming opportunities for the population. As for who we're currently using, is we are still using Viapath with the tablet pilot at Highland Mountain. The other tablets with the court system, those are court-issued tablets on their network, so it's not using another company. But if this legislation was to pass, we would be seeking to follow the procurement method before doing any further, and we would be coming back before the legislature to seek funding to assist us with establishing any type of tablet program within other institutions.
Thank you for that explanation.
Great. Additional questions? Representative McCabe?
Thank you. And through the chair, hi, Jan. Ms. Winkleman, anytime I see a zero fiscal note for something this huge, it concerns me very much. So I've been doing a little research on companies that why the tablets are free. And it's kind of the same reason it seems like printers are next to nothing, because it's the back end that gets you. So GTL, JPay, Securus, Global Tel Link, GTL is Global Tel Link, are all providers for these internet services in the prisons. And they make huge, huge dollars off of prisoners and off of the state eventually. And I'm wondering which ones we are considering, or do we have an RFP out for any of them? I've seen some Securus, I guess, charges 50 cents an email for prisoners, four times that for a video or if it has a picture in it. The costs are huge, so I'm wondering what kind of costs you're envisioning, the actual costs. In fact, I think before we move forward, we need to know what the back end of this is actually going to cost prisoners and the state. What is the, because it obviously needs to be a secure company, right? I mean, you can't have prisoners learning to code and then breaking, hacking into people's stuff from prison, for crying out loud. So it has to be secure both ways, which is an issue. So anyways, I would be curious to know what companies you've talked to and interested to know what their back end costs are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Your first statement through the chair to Representative McCabe, your first statement regarding the fiscal note, we do have a zero fiscal note on this one. This legislation we put a zero fiscal note because this legislation only gives us the authority. Our intent is depending on the final version, and if this legislation were to pass, then we would evaluate what and how we can deploy the tablets in the most beneficial fashion for the department to maintain the cost. What our vision is to go out for an RFP and limit the cost. We are hopeful that from reducing and becoming more efficient, that we can redirect some of those cost avoidance over to the cost of the tablets. The tablet program at Highland Mountain is $50 a month per user, and that's based on what we currently and how we are currently operating. Most of the vendors, several of the vendors that you mentioned, JPay, Securus, ViaPath, they are able to offer reduced cost or limited services based on the functions associated in the tablet. So if they sell a movie or they sell music or if they are selling games, then they're able to redirect a portion and some of that revenue back into the cost of maintaining and providing the services on the other end. This legislation wouldn't allow that, and so we are waiting to see what the final legislation would be, and then we can go out for an RFP to limit and try and maintain the cost, but we would follow the budget process to implement funding and to move a pilot or continue the pilot program throughout into other institutions. So it would be a budget ask in the future.
Thanks.
And Ms. Wilkerson, I actually have a follow-up on that question. Can you elaborate a little further what you mean by we would have some cost avoidance in other areas with the adoption of the tablets?
To the chair, I thank you for that question. So one of the things that we are able to do is reduce paper printing for the population. They're able to have complete a form online, and it can go into their account, and that document will follow them throughout their stay or throughout while they have an account. My understanding is they can even access the account after they leave custody to ensure that they have the proper documentation. But as we are able to reduce the manual burden of following an RF request for information around the facility and redistributing it, if that becomes automatic, then that's going to free up officer time to refocus on other areas, which will ultimately, hopefully, lead to reduced staffing costs. We also think one of the other things that we are hoping is reduced printing and delivering of documents unless asked for it, that those can all become automated and being posted into the offender's account. We also feel that if and as we see increased visitation, if video visitation does get turned on, that will reduce the, and we anticipate it reducing it, our in-person visitation, which also ultimately reduces the staff time that is associated with that. The other couple areas that we see is by utilizing telehealth or programming, it could reduce the movement of the population in and out of the facility. So those are just a few of the cost avoidance that we see are potentials for us that can then be redirected back into the cost of the tablets.
I'll hold my thoughts on that and go to Representative Holland next.
Great. Thank you. And I appreciate the testimony we've heard in the presentation. I think I had a chance to see this in the prior committee, but I'm what I learned from the prior introduction to this is just how significant the recidivism issue is in Alaska and how much it is, I think, itself driving a significant level of costs that I would really appreciate any effort that's helping control those costs and bring them down. So kind of a comment and a question related to that. The comment is that as we develop this potential technology in use, I hope we'll also be looking towards how we can engage Alaskan companies and entrepreneurs in providing these services, because hopefully this is something that gets done for a long period of time. And as we develop this sort of thing, I know I've worked with other startups that already deliver hardened tablets for different applications, not prisons yet, but I hope we'll look at this kind of emerging opportunity in Alaska as a place where we can also create business opportunities that stay in Alaska. But to that end in recidivism, I'm wondering, is there any method going on right now that is tracking the individuals who are using the tablets so that we can begin gathering data over, I think, the last year or so that these have been used and into the future, so that we can start correlating whether or not there is some impact, because this will potentially cost some money, but it will potentially save an incredible amount of money if it's reducing just a couple people that don't come back into the system, because I think we put about, $70,000 or $80,000 a year to keep somebody in the prison system. If we put $50 into a tablet, we could get a huge return on that investment. And for us to be able to justify putting the money into it, if we can see the savings, it'll make that decision very simple. But that means we need to be collecting the data now so that we can have that discussion and hopefully have that very easy decision to make down the road. So I'm wondering, is there data being collected now? If not, could we get that in some form so that when that future decision comes up, it's a simple decision to expand this?
Through the chair to Representative Holland, I might ask for Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson to help again. But I will say the question of causation and correlation will always play a role in that question. There is some research in the bill packet about recidivism in states, and we know that I think I had a quick fact here on a national level. I have some data here about participation in education programs and how much that does reduce recidivism. So we have education programs available right now. We can't make folks go and take those education programs, but if it's available to them on a tablet, I think it's human nature to want to occupy your time with something and you don't have to have an instructor there to do it. I think one of the barriers is access. So Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson might have more to add.
Deputy Director?
Thank you. For the record, this is April Wilkerson again. To the Chair, to Representative Holland, absolutely, we intend to track as much data as we can. We want to ensure the success of the tablet program as well. What I would add is that the infrastructure was completed the end of March last year, and so tablets were not issued until probably the very beginning of April. And so as they were issued with very limited. It only had the handbook, it only had digital law library, and it only had attorney-client visits. It wasn't until October where we were able to work with the vendor to get the request for information and the grievance process and the communications flowing through the tablet. So the data that we do have so far is very limited. And like I mentioned earlier, the education portion is just now being turned on, but we absolutely will have tracking capabilities to track and report back on the success and the utilization of those tablets and what they're looking at. Everything that they do on the tablet is recorded with the exception of the professional visits with their attorney clients.
Thanks. Through the chair, I just wanted to add a couple of things. One is I don't think we should overlook the opportunities for faith-based services and that kind of thing, as well as family visits. In a state as vast as ours, folks are often, so for example, in my 21 communities, there's no place for someone to be long-term. At best, they might be at Lemon Creek here in Juneau. And so this provides a family visit where an in-person visit may not be possible. So that we know also helps with folks coming out of custody more whole. But then there was also a 2014 RAND study that's in your packet that talks about the impact of education. Oh, am I not right about it being a 2014 study? Oh, might not be in the packet. Our research has a 2014 RAND study talking about the impact of education, and that reduces the post-release, and this is a national study, not Alaska, reincarceration rate by 13 percentage points. And the study found that a savings of $5 on reincarceration for every dollar spent on correctional education. So these tablets are tied to access to education.
Just a brief follow-up.
Follow-up?
Just a clarification, but we don't need to dive any further into it. But what I've heard in the responses, Chair, is that we have the ability to track the use of the tablets, and we're going to be expanding what the tablets can be used for. My question was a little more specific about, do we have the ability to track an individual that we know used the tablet, and what happened to them after they got out? And if they get rearrested, can we, in monitoring the recidivism statistics, can we correlate whether or not they had had access to a tablet or not? I know it's speculative in terms of, you know, the statistical significance, but that's what I'm looking for, is data that we might have that might correlate or be used with these other national studies. But it'd be good to have some Alaska data that says somebody that happened to be at Highland that was using a tablet last year, that those people coming back are half the rate of folks that were at Goose Creek. Again, I'm just being a little fanciful here, but that would be ideal for us to be able to know that we've actually done something and we can see a change in the recidivism rate of Alaskans and correlate it back to different services, different products, different tools, that we gave them access to. So we can follow up on that more later, but I just want to clarify why I was asking that question.
If I may.
Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson, and then we're going to move to Representative Moore.
Through the chair to Representative Holland, thank you for the clarification. And what I would say is absolutely, we do have the ability to track recidivism. And for those individuals that are returning back into custody, we can go in and see what programming they received previously. Did they participate? Did they complete it? Were they a successful completion? And so adding in the tablets, and whether they were issued a tablet and what they did on that tablet, that is something that we could add into our reporting, and we intend to add into our reporting elements based on the programming that, yes. So the answer is yes.
Thank you.
I think last question on this legislation today, Representative Moore.
Thank you. And I might have a couple questions through the chair. And you may know, but maybe that we'll have to ask the deputy commissioner, but the $50 a month that's being, I mean, the piloting program at Highland, it was quoted that it's a $50 a month per tablet. What does the $50 a month entail?
Through the chair, to Representative Moore, the $50 covers the access, it covers the setting up the system, setting up the user, it covers any connectivity, it covers the software updates, the security elements that are being utilized on it. I have a list that I'm looking for right in front of me, but it definitely it covers the service being provided for the offender to be able to utilize that tablet, similar to your phone, having that access and that ability and the service that they are providing.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up.
And then, so I'm assuming the language in this bill, some of the things are being piloted already on these tablets, so entertainment, online education courses. In other states, the entertainment is charged to the inmate. The inmate also will pay for online education courses, and the inmate also pays for, there's a fee attached to text messaging, there's fees attached to emailing. Is that something that is being piloted in this program, or is the inmate paying for the services that they want to do on the iPad?
So, through the chair to Representative Moore, we do not have any entertainment on the devices at this point. That's not allowed under current statute. So that is not even an option. They do have instant messaging, and they do have the emailing capabilities, and those are paid by the sender of the message.
Okay, follow up.
Follow.
Last one, I promise. I guess the pilot's not completed, so you guys probably don't have a lot of information on how you would recoup some of these funds. If the bill goes through, would you be charging for entertainment and online ed courses? And is there been any kind of conversation or decisions made around charging the inmate monthly to cover that $50 fee that would need to be figured out in a fiscal note with no anticipated future fiscal impacts right now? Are we looking at options for that in the future so this could be a viable option without having to charge the state a bunch of money for these?
Through the chair to Representative Moore, and maybe this is a better question for the sponsor, but from the department's standpoint, the way we read the legislation, there is no ability to allow for entertainment in the legislation as it currently is. That's how we are viewing it. And then for the electronic mail or the electronic visitations, those are prohibited from being charged back to the inmate. So it would be something that we would need to negotiate with a vendor and come back before the legislature to seek funding if we were to move forward with full implementation.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm sure we have a few more questions out there. I think we're going to go ahead and set House Bill 35 aside for this afternoon, and we are taking this up at our next hearing this weekend, so we will be able to have further discussion on the legislation before us. So thank you to our invited testifiers, especially to our bill sponsor and to Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson for answering questions today. At this time, we are going to switch to our last item on today's calendar, which is an introductory hearing on House Bill 16 related to campaign contribution limits from Representative Shragi's office. If Representative Shragi and his staff would like to come up, we'll take a very brief at ease. Doesn't look like we need it. Okay, great. If you all want to put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Representative Shragi for the record. I represent House District 12 in Anchorage, and it's an honor to be here before the committee. Before you today is House Bill 16, an act amending campaign contribution limits for state and local office, directing the Alaska Public Offices Commission to adjust campaign contribution limits for state and local office once each decade beginning in 2031, and relating to campaign contribution reporting requirements. For a little bit of background, in 2024, a ballot petition was certified after a grassroots effort gathered nearly 30,000 signatures from Alaskan voters and met the 7% threshold in 32 out of Alaska's 40 House districts, putting this ballot measure before the voters in 2026 if the Alaska legislature does not pass materially similar legislation. For the committee's knowledge, HB 16 mirrors that ballot initiative. For a little further background, Alaska has historically touted some of the strongest, most effective campaign finance laws in the nation, which serve to promote better accountability and trust in our elections and in our elected officials. In recent years, Alaskans have shown their support for fair and reasonable contribution limits, including a 2006 ballot initiative that passed overwhelmingly with 73% support. Unfortunately, in 2021, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down Alaska's statutory campaign contribution limits, opening our state and local elections to threat of unlimited political contributions directly to candidates from anyone, anywhere in the country, and at any amount. House Bill 16 reinstates fair and reasonable and constitutional campaign contribution limits adjusted to Alaska's Consumer Price Index moving forward, ensuring that these limits remain constitutional, and we'll talk more about that. To accomplish this, House Bill 16 does the following. It moves Alaska's campaign contributions, our limits, to a per-election basis as opposed to a per-year basis. It increases the statutory individual-to-candidate limit from $500 per year to $2,000 per election cycle. And it takes the group-to-candidate limit from $1,000 per year to $4,000 per election cycle. Finally, it directs the Alaska Public Offices Commission to adjust contribution limits for inflation. These changes address the concerns laid out by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the United States Supreme Court precedent while upholding the expressed desire of Alaskan voters for fair and reasonable contribution limits for transparency in our elected officials and our elections. With that, if the chair wishes, I'd like to ask my staff, Amanda and Demo, to move forward with our presentation on the bill.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Ms. Ndemo.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amanda Ndemo, staff to Representative Shragi. Today, I will be giving a brief presentation on HB 16. First, I'll provide an overview of the history of political contributions in Alaska, highlighting key legislative action, legal challenges, and reforms from 1974 to today. Alaska has a long history of regulating political contributions, balancing the need to prevent corruption with the constitutional right to free speech. However, recent court decisions have significantly altered our campaign finance landscape. So, starting in 1974, Alaska adopted its first significant campaign finance regulations in response to national concerns over political corruption. Alaska's statutory individual contribution limits began at $1,000. Adjusted for inflation, this amount would be $5,303 today. This limit was in effect till 1995. These limits were changed in 1996 to $500 following a citizens initiative after the legislators' reaction to a citizens' initiative that was aimed at reducing these limits. Adjusted for inflation, this amount would be $933. In 2003, the legislature passed SB 119, which raised the individual contribution limit back to $1,000, approximately $1,638 today. In response to concerns about political corruption, Alaskan voters reaffirmed a $500 limit in 2006 through ballot measure one. This measure passed overwhelmingly with 74% support. This limit remained in effect over a decade, but it was never adjusted for inflation, making it one of the strictest in the country. This limit was later overturned in 2021 with the decision in Thompson v. Hebden. So this case was initially brought forward in 2015 in federal district court. David Thompson and others filed a lawsuit challenging the $500 individual contribution limit as a violation of the First Amendment. The lower court upheld the contribution limits, ruling that they were narrowly tailored to prevent corruption. The plaintiffs appealed to the Ninth Circuit in 2018. The Ninth Circuit upheld the district court's ruling, maintaining that Alaska's strict limits were sufficiently justified and closely drawn to a state interest, preventing corruption being the sufficient justification. The case was then petitioned and heard by the Supreme Court. The Ninth Circuit's decision was vacated and remanded for reconsideration, with the Supreme Court citing to Randon v. Sorrell, a 2006 decision on Vermont's $400 contribution limit that was determined to be unconstitutional. Of importance from this case is the five-factor test, which provides guidance on whether a state's contribution limits violate the First Amendment rights of individuals and political organizations. More specifically, the five-factor test asks whether the limits are so low that they risk disadvantaging challengers compared to incumbents, the limits are unduly restrictive on the ability of political parties to support their candidates, volunteer services or expenses considered contributions that would count, whether volunteer services or expenses are considered contributions that would count toward the limit, the limits are adjusted for inflation, and if there is a special justification warranting a contribution limit so low or so restrictive that is based on a valid government interest. Of these five factors, Alaska failed to meet this threshold because contribution limits were too low and had not been adjusted for inflation since being initially implemented. So where are we now? In 2021, APOC issued an advisory opinion following the court's decision in 2021. They set an annual limit of $1,500 for contributions from an individual to a candidate and $3,000 limit for a group to a candidate contribution. These numbers were based on the limits that were established by the Alaska legislature in 2003, which was a $1,000 contribution limit for an individual to a candidate, but increased for inflation. APOC's five commissioners voted on whether or not to accept the staff's advisory opinion. Three out of five voted in support. However, the staff's advisory opinion was not accepted because they failed to get the required four votes. Alaska currently has no individual to candidate limits, out of state contribution limits, or individual to group limits. This has left our state and local elections open to unlimited outside funding. HB 16 aims to offer a balanced approach to the reinstatement of campaign contribution limits in Alaska. HB 16 seeks to modify the existing limits on campaign contributions for state and local offices by establishing the contribution limits. It also establishes contribution limits based on an election cycle, ensuring consistent limits regardless of election timing or candidate entry date. Additionally, it directs APOC to adjust these limits every decade, starting in 2031, to account for inflation. Shown in the slide is a summary of HB 16's proposed contribution limits. Individual contribution limits were previously set to $500. Adjusted for inflation, this is $751 today. And the new limits would be $2,000. An individual's contribution limits to a political party and a non-political party's contribution to a group, non-group entity, or political party is set at $5,000. This has not changed and was not an issue with the court. A non-political party to an individual is set at $4,000. A non-group entity to a non-group entity was set at $1,000 in 2006, which is $1,501 today. The new limit is $4,000. A group to joint campaign for governor and lieutenant governor is $2,000, which is $3,003 today. The new limit is $8,000. And this is just a simple infographic of those changes. And this slide provides a visual of the five-factor test from Randall v. Sorrell and how HB 16 implements those specific questions that were asked by the court. And yeah, so overall, this initiative brings Alaska's individual to candidate and individual to group political contribution limits in compliance with Thompson v. Hebden's court decision. And it reestablishes limits Alaska voters support. And yeah, and we urge you to support HB 16. If you'd like, I can read through the sectional, but we can also move to questions.
Let's just open it up to questions at this time. Thanks, Ms. Ndemo. I noticed we had some invited testimony. We might be able to bring them back at the next hearing, but I don't see them available at the moment. Do we have questions from committee members? Representative Holland and then McCabe.
Right. I guess I just want to ask a couple simple questions at the moment. One is, and I kind of feel like I shouldn't have to ask, but I'm asking, and that is, do these limits apply to all races, from a local assembly, school board, to state races, to federal races for the president? Is this the full gamut of any election that is held and managed by the state that these limits apply to, or is there a subsection of which races this applies to, through the chair to, I assume, the bill sponsor?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record, to Representative Holland. Thank you for the question. So federal elections are governed through federal law. So this would just apply to races here in Alaska. So think governor, state legislature, Senate and House, down to municipal races as well.
Follow up?
And then for clarification, there was a citizens initiative that I believe has been certified. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, does this proposed bill comply with the citizens initiative to the degree that this would, if passed, negate the need for that citizens initiative proceeding to the ballot?
Thanks for the question. Through the chair, this bill exactly mirrors the initiative that was certified to appear on the 2026 ballot.
Thank you.
I do see that we have one of our invited testifiers, at least here. If we could have her come on forward, we'll go ahead and do that at this time.
Oh, I thought you were going to do it on Saturday.
We'll have Ms. Charmin Haley come forward, if you could put your name on the record. And
I was just on the Senate side on the same bill, giving the same talk. Yes, my name is Charmin Haley. I have spent my career as a policy analyst and researcher, first for the Washington State Republican Caucus in the legislature. Then I came up to Juneau and worked for House Research, Legislative Research Agency, and then House Research Agency. Then I went back to graduate school in economics and came back and worked as a professor at the Institute of Social and Economic Research. I retired 10 years ago, and besides traveling a lot and spending time with my grandkids, I am still very active volunteer, citizen activist on Alaska public policy issues that I care about. Number one on this current era is campaign finance, which I've basically been working on this issue for about 10 years, ever since Citizens United. I currently work with Alaska Move to Amend, Citizens Against Money in Politics, American Promise, which is a national organization, and of course, ordinary citizens and politicians of all stripes who care about this issue. Today, we're talking about House Bill 16. The bill should not be controversial. It is unassailable legally and has solid support among your constituents across the political spectrum. The bill contains the same language as the Citizens Initiative that will be on the 26th ballot, but we hope the legislature will pass it this session and save us all the trouble. It is unassailable legally because it was carefully crafted to conform to the five criteria dictated by the Ninth Circuit Court that struck down our old law. Any gray area that might be grounds for legal challenge was stripped out of it, and it did pass muster with the Alaska AG before it was certified. It's politically solid because time and time and time again, Alaskans have demonstrated their support for strong campaign finance laws. The old campaign finance law, which also began as a citizen initiative, was enacted by the legislature in 1996. It was one of the strictest in the country with contribution limits of $500. The legislature thought that was a little low because you have to do a lot of fundraising. And in 2003, they upped it to $1,000. But voters stepped up again in 2006 and said, excuse me, we meant what we said. We passed another initiative reducing the limit back down to $500. That one in 2006 passed with a 73% approval rating. I went into the state archives 3 days ago and looked at the official results, and it passed with a solid majority in every single district of the state without exception. So we want the campaign finance limits to be strict because it protects the balance of power as voters and constituents, and limits the disproportionate influence and corrupting power of big money in our elections. In 2020, there was a poll of Alaskans that showed that 71% of Alaskans would support a U.S. constitutional amendment restoring our full authority to set reasonable limits on political spending in elections, including independent expenditures, which, as you know, in Citizens United, the court said we couldn't touch, we couldn't limit. According to the results of that poll, the support for a constitutional amendment restoring our authority to limit independent expenditures is strong across both political parties and independents. I probably don't need to restate the limits in this bill. You have that. I would have chosen a lower limit than $2,000. I ran the numbers a couple years ago, but there've been a lot of inflation since then, and I accept the political judgment of the sponsors that $2,000 was a politically safer number. The two big improvements in this bill over the old law are that the limit is per election cycle and not per year. Savvy people used to sometimes double dip in December and January. And it automatically adjusts the limits for inflation every 10 years, which is one of the requirements from the Ninth Circuit Court. So I and my fellow Alaskans, your constituents, support this bill and call on you to support it also. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Ms. Haley, for your work on this and your testimony. Do we have questions from the committee for our invited testimony or our bill sponsor? I think I saw Representative McCabe before we took testimony.
Thanks, and through the chair, and I'm not sure who it's for. Maybe Representative Shragi, but I'm just interested in definitions. So, and maybe they're elsewhere in the statute itself. I just don't see them. But I'm interested in the difference between a group and a non-group. And what is a group? What is a non-group?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record, thanks for starting off with an easy question as I reach into the recesses of my mind to try and remember that one. I may ask to get back with you on that just because I am jumping into this from another committee and it is somewhat technical. Let me do a little digging unless my staff here is prepared to answer that question.
Yes, through the chair, Representative McCabe. So for that provision, it can actually be found in AS 1513-400, so the definitions for group and non-group entity, that's AS 1513-400.
Saved by the staffer. Awesome. Thank you.
Additional questions? Representative Moore.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Scroggie, why did you not take the opportunity in this bill to make APOC a little bit more accountable? It seems maybe the commission needs a better, clearer direction through statute. I don't know of any candidate in this building that wouldn't like to see some direction on that. So is there a reason why we didn't add a little bit more in here just to make it comply with statute, or was that just convoluting the bill a little bit too much? Or
Through the chair, could you clarify the question? What do you mean when you say you'd like to have APOC a little more accountable? Or what improvement would you be looking for?
Well, when I say that, I mean like we're talking about overall money going into, you know, fixing limits and whatnot. So I guess I'm just asking why we didn't take the opportunity to overhaul APOC a little bit here.
Yeah, sure.
Through all of the limits.
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record, to Representative Moore. So just a little further history on this. This effort, for me, started after the court struck down our limits. And my initial approach to this was we just need to fix the immediate hole in our campaign finance structure that was created by that court ruling. And so we wanted to take the lightest touch, most straightforward approach to restoring campaign contribution limits in Alaska, which this bill does. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to talk more about how it does that and the mechanics and why this is a valid structure for limits moving forward. With respect to the Alaska Public Offices Commission, you know, I haven't been in politics for very long, but I will say that as a candidate, as an elected official, I frequently hear concerns around APOC. But those concerns that I hear are pretty varied. They run the gamut from everything of APOC isn't funded well enough and they don't have enough staff and expertise to be able to provide enough direction and assistance to candidates, to questions around why doesn't APOC have the ability to proactively enforce campaign finance laws. And my understanding or my response to some of those questions is, you know, on the funding aspect, that's a policy decision for the state if we want to beef up APOC so that they can provide more support and guidance and have staff more readily available to turn around questions that they receive and get answers to people. That's a policy decision that is before us as a legislature, and we could go down that route. Again, my approach was just to address the lack of limits. On the enforcement mechanisms that APOC has, that's another policy choice that we could take on as a legislature, but in my experience talking with legislators and other people involved in campaigns is that there's not a consistent view of how APOC should be structured. Some people really don't want APOC to have enforcement mechanisms because then you're kind of creating a, you know, state police entity of sorts that's going in and, you know, Representative Candidate Carrick gets a knock on the door, you know, open up your books, and now they're combing through and, you know, you could almost weaponize the agency in that way. Most, I think, people are more comfortable with what they know today, which is it's a complaint-based system where if someone notices something that seems odd, they're able to file a complaint, and that's what triggers enforcement action and investigation. But again, this is something that the legislature could take a look at, and if we wanted APOC to have that enforcement capability, that's something that we could do, although I'd be fairly reluctant because, again, my primary mission in this is to just make sure that we take care of this gaping hole in campaign finance. And then if we wanted to build off of that in future years or through other legislation, I'd be more than happy to go down that road with fellow legislators.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, through the chair. I, too, like the testifier today, would have preferred lower limits. But I'm wondering, with the citizens' initiative that this matches, what was the proportion of people who supported this?
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record. So with the ballot initiative, you're not able to get a percentage of people that supported it because the way the ballot initiatives work is you're trying to collect a certain minimum number of signatures, both as an aggregate number and across a number of districts in the state of Alaska. We met the initiative sponsors, myself included, did meet that signature gathering threshold, but that doesn't necessarily speak to the level of support that exists within the state of Alaska. I would point to some very recent polling that I saw in the last couple of weeks that put support, I can't remember the exact number, but certainly upwards of 65%, I believe it was. And if you look back at other polls and other some of the ballot initiatives that my staff walked through in the presentation, support has consistently remained well above 60%, up to 70, 75, and even higher. There is a strong appetite for this in the state of Alaska. With respect to your concern over the amount of the limits, I just want to provide a little bit further background on this, if I may. And if we go back to, let's see, one of these slides that shows the comparison. So you'll notice here, let's just take the individual to candidate limits at the very top there. We've gone from 500 to 2,000. It seems like a really large jump, but I want to remind members of the committee that we're going from a per year limit to a per election cycle limit. So that amount that you're limited to, you can now collect over 2 years. So under the old system, in that two-year period, you could collect $500 twice, $500 in the first calendar year, another $500 in the second calendar year for a total of $1,000. If you in that campaign, you'd be able to collect up to $1,000. The new limit would be $2,000 per campaign, so essentially doubling. And if you look at the amount that old limit would have been at the time of enactment, now adjusted for inflation, it'd be $751 per year, which doubled is about $1,500. We're not very far north of that. And the reason I did go a little bit north of $1,400, $1,500 is because those old limits were struck down in part for being too low. So we wanted to go a little bit above that so that we're comparable with other states, and it significantly reduces the risk that these limits are once again struck down by the courts.
Thank you for that information.
Absolutely.
Representative McCabe, I can just see the question. I don't even have to see you raise
Thanks.
Your hand.
So through the chair, I don't disagree with Representative Moore. APOC needs a haircut. I'd like to Amendment 1 say let's get rid of APOC and go with the FEC limits. That would be fabulous. But I don't know that that's possible at this in this part of Pandora's box. So I am wondering, there is also huge problems, and I get Citizens United, but there's huge problems in Alaska with outside money. And we're a cheap date. There's, you know, 500 and some odd 30,000 voters, and for just a few million dollars, they can reach all of us several times from outside the state to manipulate mostly ballot measures, not necessarily candidates, but mostly ballot measures, such as the one that might appear on our ballot if we don't do this, right? I mean, they could essentially get outside money and manipulate this ballot measure to do this or something, you know. So it's frustrating to me that we are hamstrung by the courts. Even inside your presentation here, the citizen said $500 and the legislature first said no, it's $1,000. And then the citizen said no, we said $500, and then the court said no. So I think maybe we need to start listening to the citizens, and the people I talked to this last summer are extremely upset about outside money, about the dark money, if you will, coming to Alaska to experiment with things like our election system. Whether you agree with ranked choice voting or not, if you look at the history, it's an experiment. We're the guinea pigs. So I guess my question is, would you be open to an amendment?
Thank you for the question, Representative McCabe, through the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record. So I very much share your frustration as an Alaskan who's a strong believer in campaign contribution limits. I am very frustrated by Citizens United. I think it was a major mistake. If not a mistake, it's very problematic and limits our ability to, in my view, maintain our self-determination in Alaska, to have Alaskans influencing Alaska elections and electing our elected officials to represent us. I think it's very problematic. But as you noted, Citizens United does place significant restrictions on what we are able to do as a state legislature. For background, Citizens United said a number of things, but one of the things that they said is that you can only limit contributions for a very limited set of reasons. Basically the only one of which is still valid is to fight the actuality or appearance of corruption, whereas it used to be that you could place limits upon elections for other reasons as well, for example, self-determination. There were other arguments that you could use to base your limits on. Because we now only have corruption as the only valid reason for placing limits on political donations, it has the secondary of effect of preventing us from banning out-of-state donations. Because I, as a policymaker, cannot say that an out-of-state donation has any additional risk or any more or less risk of corrupting an elected official than an in-state individual making a donation to that campaign. So Citizens United has effectively said you cannot limit out-of-state donations to your local elections. So I have worked with legislators to come up with some very creative ways to try and address that. To date, in my view, we've been unsuccessful in coming up with something that would withstand legal scrutiny. But again, I share your interest in stopping that out-of-state money and separately would like to pursue a resolution urging Congress to resolve this issue, which is the true way that we can limit those out-of-state donations. The last thing I'll just say very briefly, I want to make sure that I'm not just rambling on stuff you don't care about, but the out-of-state donations, they are very problematic. I will say that generally there is an ability for these out-of-state donations to kind of match. When you see one group dumping a bunch of money in, folks are normally able to rally an oppositional group to try and get some competing money into that media market to run counterpoint. And then I'll also say that one saving grace for us, or one maybe mediating factor, is that these independent expenditure groups do not have some of the advantages that we have as candidates in our campaigns, where we're able to get the lowest rate for our advertising dollars. Independent expenditure groups, when they come into Alaska and they want to spend money, they're charged oftentimes 7 to 10 times, if not more, the amount of money for the same advertising. So if it costs me $100 to run that mailer, obviously made up numbers, it's going to cost that independent expenditure group $700 to $1,000 to run that same mailer. So there is a bit of a diminishing effect on that outside money, although again, fully recognize it is a huge issue that I wish we could address more head on as a legislature.
We have time for just a couple more questions. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, quick follow-up. So outside money under this bill would be limited to candidates, right? I mean, somebody couldn't, not an IE, but somebody couldn't from the outside. Why can't we just treat ballot measures the same way we treat candidates? Instead, say, campaign contribution limits for state, local office, or ballot measures, and then it wouldn't probably eliminate the IEs being able to advertise, but it would eliminate them being able to contribute directly to the campaign. I guess I don't know how that would work, but I mean I'm looking like you are. I think it's unconscionable that people, without mentioning names, would get $20 million and we have $100,000 or less to oppose them.
Thank you for the question, Representative McCabe, through the chair. I would be happy to explore that with you. I would want to make sure that I want a little bit of time to think about it, make sure that it's legally sound. Let's talk about it.
Thanks.
Final question today, Representative Himshute.
Thank you. I'll try to be as quick as I can. I also was appalled in the SB 21 initiative at how much outside money came in, just like you, Representative McCabe. On this, my question is for the sponsor. So I wanted to make sure, so I like the inflation proofing. I'm a fan of that for certain things. And then through the chair, I also wanted to ask, if we pass it this year, then would these be the rules for the 26 campaign cycle?
Through the
ineffective date.
Through the chair to Representative Himshute, I need to double check. I believe that if we were to pass it and have it signed into law this year, it would be in effect for this next campaign cycle. But that is something that we will have to watch as the bill hopefully continues to progress, because if we were to have this bill not passed until the next year of the legislature, we would then be in the middle of a campaign cycle, and so we would want to adjust effective dates so that they wouldn't kick in until after that election, so that we're not imposing limits mid-campaign, which could have all sorts of trickle-down consequences.
And then follow-up comment?
Follow-up?
Unfortunately, Representative Story left, but I just wanted to point to that $2,000 per cycle limit, and that does feel high, but five of my communities I can reach by vehicle once I get there, which is a $700 round-trip ticket from my home. So in my district, I have a lot of low-income areas that just can't support, even if they might want to. So those who can support, I ask for basically my big community allows me to get to my smaller communities, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of money. So it does feel like a lot to go to 2,000, but I also have a small number of people who could give that much, and I really do rely on it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the right amount.
Yeah. Thank you. If I can just respond briefly through the chair, we've worked hard to try and come up with a number that is legally defensible, but that is reasonably low. Again, trying to match the intent of Alaskans and their very clear record through our state's history and wanting, as basically from what I can tell, as low a limit as possible. I think we have a interesting history here in Alaska with corruption and distrust of elected officials, more so at other periods in our history than now. But I think Alaskans are very sensitive to this and want to make sure that we don't have excessive donations where you really do question whether or not that is influencing the legislature in their role as an elected official, where they feel a sense of indebtedness to the individual.
Yeah. Great. Thank you very much for the bill presentation, for our invited testimony, and our bill sponsor and staff. Thanks to the committee for good discussion on this. Representative Holland.
Just to the chair, just a quick clarification. Are we still planning on public testimony on this bill on Saturday? Because I've contacted a few folks that are interested in this. I just want to make sure that I'm not sending them at an appropriate time.
Yep. So I was about to announce that what's happening for the rest of this week. So we will be bringing this legislation back up again at our next hearing. And at that hearing, we will be taking public testimony on first House Bill 16 on campaign contribution limits from Representative Schrocki's office. And then after that, we will be taking public testimony on House Bill 35 on prisoner tablets from Representative Himshute. And public testimony on House Bill 58, our Office of Public Advocate appointment from Rep. Fields' office. And we will be setting amendment deadlines for all three bills at that hearing. There will be a slightly longer amendment deadline for the campaign contribution limit bill, and slightly shorter amendment deadlines for the other two bills. And with no further business to come before the committee today, again, just thank everybody for the conversation, and we are adjourned at 5:12 p.m.